You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
That's right. Hello and welcome. I am one of your hosts, Jedi Master John Mills, and I'm pleased as ever to have... Hold on a second. Matt? Where am I right now? I've lost track. Am I at aggressive negotiations or am I at the 602 Club? Which place?
I don't know, because for the last 2 weeks, we've just kind of melded the two. It's like we've had some sort of like... Jedi tranced Vulcan mind meld of the show.
Oh, so this is like us being like Rey and Ben, but like, you know, we're like touching through the rain right now. And this is the show's coming to. And yeah, and that reference.
That's what we're doing.
I'm going to walk away from that reference before somebody listening comes in like Luke and blows this whole place apart. So there you go.
Wow. John, I feel like we got to keep him separated here.
Oh,
come on.
All right. Hey, so, and guess what? We're talking about the offspring of Han and Leia and Palpatine.
That's right.
And not Palpatine. So there you go. The offspring reference. It all comes together. That was artfully done, Matt. Well done.
Thank you. Well, we are going to have a blast as we cross over again because, we had some Star Wars stuff that was ending and starting and then ended. And so, of course, we talked about The Bad Batch Season 3 together and that crossover. And that was a ton of fun. And we thought, well, why not just do it again? Because we've got Tales of the Empire, which dropped on May the 4th. And we've both had an opportunity to watch it, I think, at least twice. I just wanted to ask you, John, we both really liked Tales of the Jedi.
Oh, yes.
And we're really excited about the idea of them doing a second season of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it came out that we weren't actually getting a second season of that, was there a part of you that was disappointed, or are you just more excited to see what they had in store?
Listen, I'll say we're not getting a second season of that yet. Okay, hope springs eternal. Keep hope alive. I'm excited for anything in this format that Tales of the Jedi and Tales of the Empire have been in, specifically because I think that short form storytelling is the way of the future, has been for some time, and it's just what audiences are used to, and it feels like an appropriate extension of what Lucas himself was going with all the way back to those Jendi Tartakovsky 3-minute episodes of it forces the storyteller to distill everything to the most brutally efficient, necessary elements to tell the story.
Right.
So whether you have a story to tell in 3 hours or 3 minutes, can you tell that story? And I think it's a fascinating challenge. And so, anytime I see Star Wars come in here, it feels natural. It feels like this is what Star Wars should be doing with formats, is busting them up, doing something, fun and original. Although at the same time, it's a callback to like the shorter cartoon series that were in the past where they're like 15 minutes long and, you know, stuff that I watched for a number of years on Cartoon Network, on Adult Swim. You know, C-Lab 2021, Aqua Teen Hunger Force, Space Ghost Coast to Coast. Those were all comedy shows, and they were all done in 15-minute blocks. Metalocalypse, all of that type of stuff. I love this short-form format because it forces you just to be really focused in what you're telling. So, sorry for the rambling answer, but short TLDR, I was excited to get this.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't frustrated that they were doing... Tales of the Empire. I think I had thought, of course, that they were going to do a second season of Tales of the Jedi. And like you, I have hope that that will happen because to me, it was one of the most incredible things that they had done in animation, in all honesty. Mm-hmm. I just loved it. And I would really like to see more of those type of stories, because I do think there are plenty of places that the Star Wars galaxy, especially in the prequel era, has places to fill in stories like that. But the fact that we were going to do this, that and that idea with, you know, Tales of the Empire was exciting to me, because there's plenty of places that you can do that with stories like we got. And so we're get two arcs, right, in this. We get the Morgan Elsbeth arc, and then we get the Barriss Offee arc. And I really liked, because I didn't watch any trailers. I only saw the poster for this, and I didn't quite realize, because I really wasn't looking at the poster really diligently, that this was Morgan Elsbeth in the first place, really. But how did you feel just about them kind of digging in a little bit more to her story to put a little bit more meat on the bones for this character?
Oh, I loved it. Morgan Elsbeth, ever since we first encountered her in The Mandalorian, like, fascinated me. Because here's somebody who's super capable, non-Jedi, wonderful fighter. And then when she came back in Ahsoka, I was like, okay, cool, great antagonist. And if she is, in fact, dead in Ahsoka, so, you know, never going to count anybody out in fantasy and sci-fi, right? Anybody can come back. But if she is, in fact, dead, then the only place, only room you have left to tell her story is in flashbacks, basically, you know, prequel stories. And so I actually appreciated getting a nice full arc with her, not the least of which because my curiosity always was, how did this person get connected to Thrawn? And so, of course, you know, this scratches that specific itch. But, you know, were you happy to get back with Ms. Elsbeth? Or,
yeah, I think, you know, to me, one of the exciting parts about having her as the character that we were going to be discussing in this arc was the fact that, you know, we knew that she was Dathomiri. And so kind of how she survives and how she finds her way into the service of Thrawn is kind of a big story, right? Because we thought, really, that Ventress was the last one, right? Or at least is what we knew. We thought their whole planet had been destroyed. And so not only do we say that Morgan Elsbeth has survived, but there's a mountain clan as well of Dathomiri women who aren't Dathomiri witches, which is very interesting. And so I loved the fact that what we're doing in this is we're expanding a lot, like the expanded universe was. We're giving you more information about this culture of beings, this race of beings. And at the same time, we're utilizing that, though, to tell us the specific story of this character. And to me, I think the beauty of this to me was the fact that what they're doing is, you know, because all the episodes are actually named this, it's fear, anger, hate, right? And it's a visual representation then of Yoda saying, and how when you go down this path, it completely consumes you and it consumes everything around you. And I thought that that was just phenomenal because, you know, again, playing in the prequel era, right? We see that, you know, and we know where her story ends too, at least we think it ends. And it's like, yeah, she just, her hate never actually really leads to good things for her. She has a pretty sad life when you see it. And so I really enjoyed, again, it's one of those things where it's not beating you over the head, right? It's just as you're watching the story, you're immersed in it. And if you're paying attention, it's very easy to pick up the lesson that they're going for.
It is. I think it's interesting that in that arc, there's a sense of disappointment from her when the town doesn't love her for, quote unquote, everything she's done for them.
Yes.
It's so interesting because it shows nobody thinks they're the bad guy. Everybody thinks they're justified in what they do. I thought that was such a nice little flourish to add to remind everybody. Morgan Elsbeth thinks she's justified in everything that she's doing. She doesn't sit there, twirling the Beskar staff around going, ha, 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 I'm evil. She's going, no, I'm right. Why can't they see that? Everything I've done for them, it's really dysfunctional. But to back it up even further, and I know this is a minor thing, and I'll come back to the arc with Morgan, but can I just say, because I must be just sick inside in some way, but simply hearing Grievous's gleeful, psychopathic laughter while he's on his murder spree, I miss that character so much, man. I miss Grievous so much. He was so much fun.
Yeah.
Like, I loved him in episode 3, and then when they made him a prominent player in Clone Wars, I was like, oh, yeah, like, I can't get enough Grievous. And if you announce a 6-episode arc that was just Tales of Grievous, I'd be like, sold. I am going to watch the equivalent of 10,000 people watching this episode in one day. But to bring it back to Elsbeth, what I think is really interesting is it also shows how everybody misses meet the new boss, same as the old boss, because Morgan winds up and it is an absolutely beautiful opening in that second episode when the two Venators are going and then the Star Destroyer, as we know it, comes up.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
And, I mean, just an incredible shot. But then that conference room that they're in, number one, was so masterfully evocative of the conference room in 2001 where they're on the moon base. And just has that vibe of that 1970s sci-fi vibe that you want evoked from that era. But the fact that Elsbeth can't realize that she's putting herself in the employ of the very people, essentially, who murdered her people. But because the dressings are all different, it's like she's, does she get it? Does she not get it? Or does she not care? She just wants to inflict pain because she's hurt. And it's like, I think it's just a really interesting sort of structure in which to find her. Mm-hmm. And then just having Palayan come up to her. I love this idea that Palayan's been sort of like Thrawn's front man for so long, going forward and scouting the talent, as it were.
I think that you're 100% right on the idea that Morgan doesn't care, that she is just so angry, it actually blinds her to the truth of the Empire and what it is and what it represents. I don't think she has the ability to see that depth because she is consumed by her hatred. And I think that that's one of the things that we see about evil in Star Wars, right? Is that in the end, it does cloud your judgment big time, I think that, just having rewatched Return of the Jedi, isn't that the big argument between Luke and the Emperor? Your overconfidence is your weakness. Your faith in your friends is yours, and that's really important to the series, right? Because it is Luke's love and belief in his friends that outwits, outlasts, and outplays, right? Mm-hmm. The Emperor. And I think that there's something really beautiful about that. And I think that's the key to Star Wars, right? George even said, that for him, this was really about, there's a good and there's an evil. And when you live your life within the good, things tend to go better for you. And Morgan Elsbeth is very much representative of the person who can't see that. The old saying is, when you go for vengeance, dig two graves. Well, we see the consequence of her actions, you know, with the Mountain Clan, right? She can't let go. And what happens? She gets the Mountain Clan chief's daughter killed. And so she never really stops to think about the consequences of her own actions. And so, I just think that that's something incredibly interesting. And it's, again, this whole arc really just encapsulates the way in which all evil in Star Wars is always going to be at a disadvantage to that which is good, right? Like, we even see that at the end of this arc, right? The Empire lost, the New Republic won. And even though she wants to disregard that, you know, we know the end of her story. She doesn't win. Mm. She dies. You know,
she kind of
has a win. You know,
the greater arc of getting thrown back to the galaxy to create. I mean, it's mischief. It's, you know,
it's good. It's interesting, but you know, we also know that, and that's the thing about Star Wars. Like that, we always know somehow that our heroes are going to find a way to overcome whatever obstacle it is that's thrown in front of them. And so I don't know. This is I just thought this really cool too, even just the way in which they also create her introduction with Thrawn by her taking his old program and actually making it better.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was incredibly interesting. And in that, you know, Thrawn mentioning he sees the coming end of the Empire because of its unwillingness to take care of its own people. It's going to leave it weak because people are going to stop believing in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought all the whole thing, man, it's like it's the thing that we talk about every time we're talking about Star Wars animation. Just when you start to play in your mind all that's happening in these 12 to 15 minute episodes, it's pretty astounding.
Right. It's storytelling boiled down to its most brutally essential elements. And that is always going to be where Star Wars excels, you know. And I think that I actually think one of the greatest things is it would have been so easy for the storytellers here to rely too much on too much Thrawn, as it were, and have him dominate at least two of these episodes, but they very wisely keep it Morgan Elsbeth's story. This is not Thrawn's story. This is Elsbeth's story, and we only get as much Thrawn as we need to explain their connection. And I think that that is great. I also love the fact that they have the tension of the town and the town leader that we already know from The Mandalorian highlighted and showing how Elsbeth is never going to achieve the great power that somebody like Palpatine has in mind. But she's Palpatine on a smaller scale. She rules with an iron fist. She thinks she's always right. She wants to dominate. And she has a vision. She specifically calls out she had a vision, and that's what she's focused on, and that's exactly what undoes the Emperor, too, is he thinks he has the best vision, and vision literally in the prophesying sense, and we know what path that's going to send her down. Now, one thing I wanted to ask about that last episode with you, though, is when we hear Ahsoka on the comlink.
It's not Ahsoka. No, it's Bo-Katan. Yeah, it is Bo-Katan.
Because I was gonna mention the voice. I thought it was Ahsoka because it was setting up Ahsoka going there.
No. So in fact, if you look at the credits, it's Katie Sackhoff.
See, as Bo-Katan. That's why it didn't sound like Ahsoka to me. But at the same time, I don't watch the credits. I just presumed that it was Ahsoka,
mm-hmm.
Or supposed
to
be.
I thought it was going to be at first, and I was like, wait, that's not the right voice.
Yeah, that's...
And then
I thought it was hearing Rosario Dawson through a filter, and I was like, oh, that must be what it is. I didn't realize that it was Bo-Katan. I understand why they would do that. But, and I know if I just looked at the credits, I would have known. But listen, man, I'm going to go ahead and say that's, you know, I'm not going to put that on myself. I'm not going to put that on anybody. But I think you could hold me relatively blameless for that confusion, couldn't you? I can't be the only fan that presumed that was Ahsoka on the other end of the line.
I don't think that anyone could blame you for that. And I think what it's so great is that, you know, we know the bond that she and Ahsoka had at the end of the Clone Wars with what we saw in Mandalore. They've created this really nice relationship. And so to see that will then continue in the future is pretty great, right? And so... And connecting the dots then of that it would be Bo who passes on that message to Ahsoka that because, you know, and that's where it's like, oh, man, I would really like to see a story where we connect those dots, right, of the relationship between Ahsoka and Bo-Katan in that time period, because it's pretty tumultuous for Bo-Katan as well, right? Yeah. She loses Mandalore, and there's just so much that happens there, and it just is rife with storytelling ideas. It's like it's rife almost with you know, having a great novel written about that or something. You know, like this is the type of stuff that I love that we're doing as we and this is what we talked about with season 3. Of the Bad Batch. These animated shows are doing such a great job of being that connective tissue for the entire saga. And this is one of those places where that is happening.
And it makes me just more frustrated with the live action series, because the template is there for success. And I'll carry forward a conversation I was having over on House Lights on the Nerd Party about Star Trek Nemesis. Now, I'm building to a point here, right, where Nemesis, one of its errors in its planning was, you know, they wanted to make Star Trek, you know, broad and accessible for the, you know, the general public again. But by that point, Star Trek is so deep in its own mythos that I would posit that was the problem. The first thing you have to do is you have to win over the diehards. You have to win over the fans and make them so crazy happy with your product that they're going to go out and say, no, 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 you got to see it. You got to see it. You got to see it. And get the cash fans in there and get people in. I made the same point about Nemesis over there on House Lights. And I would make the same point here, because the animated stuff has figured out that sweet spot to make us, with these stories, so excited that we want more, that we're clamoring for more, that we're saying, you'd be nuts not to do these series. I want Tales of the Jedi Volume 2. I want Tales of the Mandalorians. I want Tales of the Rebellion. I want these 15-minute episodes. I want 6. Start churning them out. You know, at least 6-episode series a year. Bring them out to me, right? And that's what I think really needs to be carried forward and evangelized, if you will, to those making the live action shows, is those of us sitting here having these in-depth discussions about the programs, you've got to win our hearts, as many of our hearts as you can, so that we go out and we market for you, because that's how this works now. And I know it seems like I'm belaboring the point, but that is why Tales of the Empire is so great. That's why Bad Batch Season 3 is so great, because it fires me up. And when somebody says, oh, I'm a Star Wars fan, I can say, hey, did you catch Tales of the Empire? Hey, did you watch Bad Batch Season 3? Because they're great. You got to see them. I'm not going out and saying to them, hey, did you catch? I'm not throwing shade. There were things about it that I like too. But I'm not saying, man, Book of Boba Fett, right? No, I'm talking about the animated stuff, because mm-hmm. they've unlocked the story potential that we all want. Sorry, I'm off my soapbox.
No,
I'll stand down.
No, there's nothing to apologize for. Obviously, I think everybody who knows our relationship and our conversations knows that I 100% agree with you in that. And I think you bringing up that conversation that you guys had on House Lights is 100% accurate. I mean, that's what happened, right, with that show. You're at a point in a series when what really matters is the fans, because they're the ones who are therefore the ambassador for that series moving forward. And if they are not then invested in that series anymore, and you're not giving them something to be excited about and then go tell others about, you don't have any ambassadors anymore. And that's what you need in a series, is you need somebody to be an ambassador for your series. And I think that's, you know, what they've learned. You know, I think it's one of the places where, and I'll make a reference to, you know, we did this on a Assembling Avengers, right? We were talking through all the Marvel stuff. And what happened with Marvel? They started to lose everybody because it wasn't interesting enough for you to want to continue with. They mm-hmm. weren't keeping you interested because it wasn't focused enough. It just, you know, something was missing. And that's what I think this stuff for Star Wars is doing right. It doesn't feel like there's something missing. It, like you said, it's leaving us like, oh my gosh, I just need to know more about this and I need more of this, you know. And that's the fantastic thing. And that's a place, too, where as we look at that second arc with Barriss, you know, that's a character who had been left on the side, right? She had been left as that series wrapped up. We didn't know what happened with her. And so we all assume that something must have happened with her because, you know, she is a Jedi who had questioned the Jedi Order, was taken into custody, and soon after that, you know, it became the Empire. So why wouldn't they be interested in her? Mm-hmm. And so to then, through her, begin to get to see the beginnings of the Inquisitorial Squad was, I think, a phenomenal way of using this character to not only tell her story, but at the same time help us understand a story of how the Empire begins creating this anti-Jedi, right? This perverse version of the Jedi, this perverse family, right? Which I loved.
I loved as well. One point I'll go to, and then we can back up, but one thing I want to say is that when Vader walked in that second mm-hmm. episode, first and foremost, an incredible, it wasn't the second episode. It was the first episode. I'm sorry. When she becomes the Inquisitor,
end of the first episode,
when Vader walks in, the attention to detail on his costume. Trust me, I have the pre-Empire Strikes Back costume for Darth Vader is burned behind my retinas. I see it in my dreams, and everything down to how the cod piece is laid out to the it's not just the way that the fabric is laid out over the armor and stuff like that. It is to a T, and it thrilled me. It filled my soul with happiness to see it. And that shot where you see his head sit down, I've never seen a more photorealistic animated depiction of anything before. It looked like mm-hmm. they had somebody in the actual outfit shot there, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
But to double back, One of the things I love about the way the arc kicks off, I truly love it, is that she's hearing, echoing through the Force, the horrors of Order 66 going down. And that is a huge touchstone. It gets back to what we've talked about before with the Bad Batch and everything like that. I have an anchor point. I know exactly what moment in time and what's going on. You don't have to waste any backstory with somebody saying, hey, did you hear about what happened at the Jedi Temple? Oh, hey, did you know this sort of... No. Boom. It's that efficient storytelling. Using audio and her waking up from that nightmare, I know in less than 10 seconds, oh, this is where I am. And this is where the arc is kicking. Got it. After Effects here.
Yep.
Just like starting Elsbeth's arc with the slaughter on Dathomir. Oh, okay. I know exactly where we are. I know. Okay. You don't have to waste any backstory with me. I know where we're starting from. What did you think of seeing the Inquisitorius Inquisitorium? The building's the Inquisitorium? Whatever the building's called. What did you think of seeing it under construction?
I loved that too, because like you mentioned, with that, we know exactly where we are in the timeline. We know that we're at the very beginnings. Like this is the Empire is very, very young, right? And that we haven't been around for a while. And so therefore, we haven't been around all that long. And so I think that it just, it's really cool to see that we are on the ground floor. Like Barriss is one of the original Inquisitors, you know, and in fact, you know, the person that she's facing off with too is one of the original Inquisitors to be brought in to see if they could be, you know, an apprentice, to be a brother in this, again, this perverse family that they're creating. And I think it's fantastic. And so I loved getting to see the fact that this fortress is not complete yet. And I also got to love the fact that as we utilize many genres to tell our stories, we have a whole Dark Knight fight scene. We've only got openings for one, so we're going to have tryouts.
Yes.
And that was amazing.
It was incredible. It was one of the best touches of any of the episodes released in Tales of the Empire. I had the same thought that you did, where it's like, oh, unfortunately, this only one open. Oh, here you go. And all that was missing was...
I was just like, the pull cue.
Yeah, all that it was missing was Heath Ledger whispering, make it fast. But that actually plays into something that I wanted to bring up, because the arena where they're fighting, first and foremost, how beautiful a fight is it? Where it's like, oh, they wouldn't dare kill us. I don't care. I'm not taking that chance. And like, you know, forcing each other into that only the strong survive sort of thing. But I got to know, I'm dying to know now, the origin of all of the stone with the runes on it at the core of the Inquisitorium, whatever the building's called. I loved that touch.
Yeah.
The idea that this was built on an old temple of some sort. Please tell me more, including one that has a bottomless pit. Like, if anything screams Sith Temple to me, all of a sudden the Mustafar system is even more interesting to me, because Mustafar wasn't just picked willy-nilly, and this planet that's there with it, oh, wait, that means there's a whole Sith history. That ties into like the old Tales of the Jedi comics that I read back in the 1990s and everything. I want to know more about that place. Like, how incredible was that to see... stone, like they have the secret staircase and the stone and the, and the runes everywhere.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think, you know, again, this is a place where we keep building on all of these things, and it keeps creating more and more questions, and incredibly fun questions for us as fans, right? to want to know where they get those stones. Like, are they transplanting?
Right.
You know, an old Sith temple to this spot here. You know, I was a little sad that we didn't get a chance to visit, you know, the basement where they keep all the Jedi that they've killed, you know. You know, I think what it does, just like Tales of the Jedi did, it lets us know there's so much more story to be able to tell here. And, you know, I think the beauty of this arc for Barriss was the fact that we are creating a very interesting redemption arc for her,
mm-hmm.
because she's a character who starts off on the right side, becomes completely disillusioned, has what she says a darkness take over her, and then is able to see the light. And what allows her to see the light is the sadistic nature of the evil that the Empire represents. In its truest form there with, I believe it's the fourth sister that she's with, Lynn. And she's finally able to see through the lies of the Empire. Because, you know, when they first get on that planet, she's like, well, you know, they're having the conversation. She's like, well, let's get them back on the right course so they can finally prosper. She believes that the Empire is going to be this thing that brings good and not evil. And what she comes face to face with is this, that the in the end, the Jedi were actually right. The Jedi that she condemned were right all along, you know, in what they were doing. Were they, did they have their faults and their foibles? Yes, but that she was wrong in that and realizes in seeing the true picture of evil, she's able, unlike Anakin, right, to be able to make the differentiation and admit that she was wrong and turn back to the very core of what was the Jedi teachings.
Well, I think it's because I'm in line with what you're talking about there. I think that because you bring up Vader, I'll always go back to there was a comic, it was Star Wars Tales or whatever. And I think it's the truest thing of all. Why does it take Vader so long to wake up? Why are there those that can't wake up from the dark side? I think what Barriss lacks is self-hatred. That is what will lock you into that crap, and you can't get out of it. And I think Elsbeth hates herself to a certain extent. There's a self-loathing there. And so I think having these arcs side by side, seeing Elsbeth lock into it more, but then Barriss come out of it, it demonstrates, I think, very clearly what is the core fundamental character difference between these two people. They're both faced with, lack of a better term, a genocidal event that wipes out everybody that they knew and loved, and then they dealt with it. How did they deal with that internal trauma? Elsbeth becomes hateful, wants to take it out on everybody else, wants to make everybody suffer as much as she did. And it's because she hates herself, because she, her sense of self-worth, I'm not talking about she blames herself for anything. I'm saying like she hates where she is, what she feels she has to do. It's self-justification on a grand scale. Anakin's in that camp. But then you contrast it with Barriss. Barriss, there was a righteousness to her actions. She realizes she was wrong, but that's because she wasn't motivated by self. Even back when she's in prison, she was misguided. She was wrong, but she was motivated by a sense of love and care that was just misdirected. And I mean, that points us to why Anakin eventually can come back out of the other end. But, you know, Barriss is sort of, you know, in miniature, that sort of echo that happens. And so I think having these two arcs, that's another thing you have to congratulate the series on, and it goes back to Tales of the Jedi as well. We're going to tell you two arcs, two people that potentially could have wound up the same way, but they processed what happened to them differently. And it leads to conversations like this, where it's like, what was fundamentally different about the two? Because they...
Well, and I mean, they do the same thing in Tales of the Jedi, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think the beauty of this is that Barriss is, like you said, the antithesis to Morgan Elsbeth. She's the one who's able to let go of fear, anger, and hate. And she's the one who helps Lynn do the same thing. Mm-hmm. To let that the one way out is to let go of those things. And the beauty of that too is there's an interesting like Harry Potter connection for me in this, which was, you know, she keeps calling the fourth sinister Lynn.
Mm.
The same way that Dumbledore and Harry call Voldemort Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the recognition of who they truly are and were that all of her denial can't get rid of the fact of who she was. And like you said, Morgan hates herself. In the end, Voldemort hates himself, right? Because he sees himself as weak. And I think that's something it's incredibly interesting. It takes true humility to be able to see yourself as you are and then be able to look to move forward, look to grow. And that's something I think is really interesting about the way in which, you know, Barriss dies here, but in this death, she also saves a life.
Yes. And I think I love the fact that you're talking about the Harry Potter thing, because there's essentially the Hall of Mirrors in that cave. And it's that, you know, the mirror of your heart's desire spelled backwards in the first Harry Potter thing, where it's like, what do you see when you look in the mirror? It's, or the Never Ending Story, or, you know, whatever thing is used, like you look in the mirror, what do you see? It's going to tell you everything you need to know. And I also have to give the editing in that third episode a special shout out for that cave sequence, especially even though in like my little lizard brain, part of my brain, I knew this had to have been when it happened, I was like, oh, of course it did. But when, when Lynn is walking around and she hears, you know, let me help you or words to that effect. And she lashes out with the saber and she winds up stabbing Barriss Offee. I gasped. Because it's the only way the story could go, but it still did it in such a way that I went, oh no. And then I had that second where I was like, of course, right? Of course that's what's going to happen. But I still, even the second and third time I watched it, it still gave me that jump, because it's like any good jump scare in a horror movie, honestly. No matter how many times you go back to it, you'll still jump a little bit. There's anybody who's seen The Exorcist 3? You know the scene I'm talking about when I say that. I still watch it to this day. I've watched the hell out of that movie over decades, and there's still one scene where I can never quite get it right when it's going to happen, and I just about jump out of my seat every time. This is that same sort of moment where it's so perfectly timed, and the buildup to it is so perfect. I mean, that cave thing could have gotten so boring, so repetitive, so dumb, but it was so perfectly put together.
Well, and the beauty of that is I think that it's a version of the cave on Dagobah, right?
Yep.
Which is you bring in only what you bring with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's why Barriss tells her there is one way out, and that's to let go of the things that are keeping you stuck here. And in some ways, it also references, Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Emissary, right? Where the prophets tell Sisko, you're stuck here. You live here, which is in the moment when his wife dies, that he's kind of rooted himself in this place and he can't let it go. And so they help him to be able to do so. And In the same way, Barriss does the same thing for Lynn, to be able to let go of that thing, which I think, like you mentioned, there is that sense of anger, hate, fear, but it's also in some ways that intense hatred of oneself that makes you lash out at everybody else and want to dominate everybody else because it's the only thing that makes you feel better about you, right?
Yeah.
And just how incredibly then, and this is, I think, the tough thing, is it shows us just how incredibly broken we are as people. And that's the beauty, I think, of this whole arc. And, you know, it's, you know, I gotta say it, but it's the mirror room done right, mm-hmm. you know, and they nail it completely. And like you said, it could have been extremely boring very quickly, but they find a way to basically do exactly the same thing that we saw in The Empire Strikes Back and make it feel fresh and new and great without me going like, oh, they've already done that before.
Yep. And what I love is Barriss follows the fine tradition that, you know, I have friends where they reject this. They don't plug into it and it's fine. You know, I'm not passing judgment on anybody, but they fixate on things. Like when Yoda says to Luke, when gone am I, the last of the Jedi you will be. But then, of course, we know Ahsoka's out there. We know that Baylan Skoll's out there. Barriss Offee was out there. We got other people that were out there. And he says, oh, but Yoda said the last of the Jedi you will be. And I will say, yeah, from a certain point of view. Because Barriss, Ahsoka, and others, they've become the Jedi that we always imagined Jedi would be like. No council, no formality to it, no bureaucratic structure, no, you know, having to talk to the Senate, no police force sort of stuff, but an ascetic who lives out there truly communing with the will of the Force. And Barriss even says it when Lynn is going to go after them. And she says, she's basically saying, she's like, yeah, you're going to go after them. Let's give them a head start. That seems fair. And, you know, and Lynn saying, you know, basically, I won't let you stand in my way. And Barriss saying, well, I'm not going to. Right? It's that trust in the will of the Force to say, if you're meant to get them, I can't stop it from happening.
Well, and not only that, too, but it's like, you're in your own way.
Yep.
And you don't realize it.
Yep.
And that's that again. There's so many layers to this, right? I think that's the thing that's incredibly right. Beautiful. Also, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, I'm agreeing with you. Like, again, we get back to the point of like the template is right here, guys. Mm-hmm. Come here and watch it.
Yeah,
this is a 15-minute episode, and look at the philosophical depth just in this 15 minutes right here.
Yeah,
we could fixate on this and we can glom onto this and say, oh, well, you know, the Jedi, this, the will of the Force, that, you know, were they ever meant to? What role does destiny and free will play with each other? You know, how obligated are you to go and, you know, and trust that, you know, to quote Spock from Star Trek VI, you must have faith that the universe will unfold as it should. No matter what Barriss Offee does, the will of the Force will determine whether Lynn succeeds in her dark side mission. Doesn't mean she won't resist her. Doesn't mean she won't try to talk to her. But she doesn't try to fight her. She doesn't try to kill her. She just talks to her. She just says to her, you know, you're going to have to be the one to find mm-hmm. your way through this. So, sorry. I get so excited about those sorts of moments in Star Wars.
100%. And, you know, I think one of the things, too, that I've loved about the animated series, and we've seen it over and over again, we, you know, obviously saw it, the fact that, you know, Thrawn is back, you're bringing in Rook, but with the Barriss Offee arc, you know, we're leaning into the Clone Wars novels that came mm-hmm. out during the prequel era, where she is and was a Jedi medic.
Yes.
And basically, the duology that she was in was MASH for Jedi. It was a great story. And so to see her become a healer here, and become this old wise woman that everybody comes to for healing and help, felt so reminiscent of those types of things that we saw in that series, you know, and just to utilize those little bits and nuggets, like to reward the fans like that, as you were talking about that idea of like, that we're rewarding those longtime fans and giving them something to get excited about. That's one of the ways they did it. And it's phenomenal. And so, I think honestly, the only question that comes down to, and I'm really interested, where do you end up with your ratings on this series?
Honestly, I'll give it a 5. I mean, listen, I'm rating it as a fan, and it's a series for fans. Did it give me everything I was looking for? Yeah, it actually exceeded expectations amazingly. It gave me beautiful stuff to watch. It gave me efficient storytelling. It gave me little moments of thrills, seeing Vader, seeing Grievous, seeing Dathomir again, finding out there's more to Dathomir than I imagined. I mean, now we've got Night Sisters, we've got Mountain Clan, and we've got the men that Maul and Savage came from. Like, Dathomir is suddenly a more complex place where I'm like, well, okay, let's go back there. Let's talk a little bit more about what's going on there. And we have more of a sense of how the Empire was coming together and how it was doomed from the start, and how somebody like Thrawn was the only one that saw it and was like, these guys don't really know what they're doing. And if I play my cards right, it's going to be my Empire because, woof. Everybody's really short-sighted here. And it's like, yeah, that's awesome. This gave me what I want. And visually speaking, strict visuals, Barriss fighting for her spot, that pit, the Joker fight, the Dark Knight fight, with the way that it is all put together, and the Star Destroyers over Coruscant and the conference room there, that scene. Visually, feast. Like, there are so many things that are visually interesting, but those are my two highlights right there that I'll just throw out there to you. So, yeah, 5 for me. Loved it. Absolutely, you know, top-notch work again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm at a place where I think I would give this a 4.5. And I think that the reasons for that I think it's with the Morgan storyline, is that I do feel like, and maybe this is just me, but I wanted a little bit more to her storyline, in the sense that, you know, we jump it seems like a lot, mm-hmm. and to go from the Empire all the way to the New Republic time period seemed to be something to where there's a lot of story there that I feel like I'm just kind of missing. I think that's the place where, I mean, if there's any criticism, basically I have, I think that her arc feels like it almost needed one more episode to really fill it out in the way that I would personally have wanted. That's a personal thing. Mm-hmm. Therefore, as I've thought more and more about it, honestly, that's just a place where I felt like I really liked it, but I also just felt like there, you know, you didn't have to just, we've talked about this a bunch, right? It's streaming, guys. You don't have to be locked into these, oh, we can only do 3 and 3. You know, if you need 4 stories in this arc and 3 in that one, do what you need to do. And to me, this felt like a place where I would have really loved to have had one more episode in between there to really flesh out her as a character.
And I find that so interesting because it is such a personal thing, because I simply love the fact, and I would stick with 3, because I get her in the Clone Wars, in the Empire, and the post-Empire.
Sure.
So I get the sense of a life lived, like all of the change that she's been through, all of the crazy stuff that's happened.
And she never
changes. And all she does is follow that same arc.
Yeah. That's
straight
true.
Through.
It's a good, very
I think that's
point.
A really interesting thing. And the thing is, I also look at it as, you know, if they really want to be completist about it, I'll probably get a book at some point. That's fine. I can live with that. I don't need one now, though. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah. Well, John, if you know people wanted to say, what's going on with John? Where might they find you and be able to catch up with what's going on in the world of Castlevania?
Well, Castlevania, a random protectorate in the world. It is a very small country, but I rule it with an iron fist wrapped in a velvet glove. You can find me as Kessel Junkie out there, running for office in 2024, the one honest candidate that you will ever find. And you can find me also on a couple of shows, obviously Aggressive Negotiations, and also House Lights over on the Nerd Party, which we mentioned earlier, where we look at the work of directors. And Matt, I mean, 602 Club, you have me on here frequently enough, and I know that this is the origin point of Aggressive Negotiations, and this is one heck of a place to be. But where else can people find you?
Well, I'm all over social media under the name Matt Rushing 02. You can also find me on the Nerd Party Network outside Aggressive Negotiations with Owl Post, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And on the TFM network outside of the 602 Club, you can find me doing Warp 5, The Artificial Tango, Saddle Up, The Orb, and sometimes you'll find me on Literary Treks. But John, you know, I think it's time to maybe close these negotiations and, you know, have people come back later, because I don't know, I'm just kind of hungry and maybe we could go and actually hang out at a bar and get something to eat.
I think that'd be great. And so I think it's time to close these negotiations, and y'all come back now, you hear?